Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings podcast, where today our guest joins us from Sydney, and that's Alexander Scanlon, the Managing Director and CEO of Barton Gold. So, good morning. Well, it'll actually be good evening to you, won't it, Alexander? How are you doing?
Yeah, doing well. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. And of course, today my co-host James is joining me rather than Kenny. James, how are you?
I'm good, Mark. I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thank you, James. So we are obviously in the Netherlands, and we were just saying that it's rather hot over here in Europe, whereas Alexander in Sydney, it's a bit cooler, which is nice. You don't often associate Australia with cooler weather, but I'm sure in the winter it's obviously a lot cooler, more like the rest of Europe when it comes to the cooler weather. But this podcast, Alexander, is all about really the people behind the business. And I know we've spoken a couple of times doing an interview on Barton Gold, catching up on some of the latest news that's going on. But really what we find is that people buy people in business, particularly when it comes to investing. You can have some of the greatest projects in the world, but if you don't have the right people behind them, driving them, promoting them and taking them forward to an ultimate end goal or vision, then really that company is going to struggle to get anywhere. So since we've spoken a couple of times and got an insight into what Barton Gold is all about, I wonder if we can, on this podcast, really just dive deep back into your past, really, where you've come from and what's led you up to Barton Gold and the kind of careers you've had, the things you've seen, the jurisdictions you've worked in, the successes and failures that you've seen. So, I mean, if I can sort of hand the floor over to you for the next 10 to 15 minutes to really give us a bit of a snapshot into you, really, into Alexander.
Yeah, look, thank you. It's a pleasure to join you guys, and certainly to discuss the bigger picture around Barton Gold in the background. I'd have to say, agree wholeheartedly that it's really all about the people. You know, you can have a great asset with a poor team, and you're not going to have a good result. Whereas if you have even a moderately good asset with a great team, you're going to get a lot farther. And that's really been a central thematic in the work that I've been doing for the past 5 or 10 years, in particular in the principal investments side of the mining space. But you know, heading back to your question around background, so I'm from North America, grew up in the U.S., went to school on the West Coast, and ended up going to school internationally. Did undergraduate degrees in both economics and finance, and then ended up going to the U.K. To do a financial econometrics degree as well as a management degree. And so I actually sort of started in a very different spectrum of the financial sector. I started by helping build a private real estate hedge fund in California. And coming out of graduate school in the UK, I was working in structured principal investments. So this was sort of multi-billion dollar cross-border principal investments originated out of Europe and North America. But I moved to Australia back in 2009, and really I was looking around for, you know, what are the opportunities to bring some of these structured finance skills and sort of background to bear here in the market. And obviously moving into the Australian market, there are some very strong sector thematics in the market, right? So in particular, mining, agriculture, and then in a very real sense, the infrastructure that connects this big system of primary industry. So I actually ended up helping set up a sort of a boutique principal investments and corporate advisory team in the mining space. And I was sort of one of the junior employees there at the time. But I found, you know, mining in particular very interesting. We had a bit of a family history with mining. Going back to my childhood, we had some involvement in gold mining in rural Idaho, which is, you know, one of the older gold mining districts in North America. So we spent a lot of time, you know, as younger children and teenagers out in the woods in Idaho. And for us, you know, as kids, it was actually just a really good excuse to get out and goof off in the woods. But it was something that sort of stuck in the back of my mind. And I've always really enjoyed tangible assets, real assets. So hence a lot of historical work, modeling and investing in real estate, but also then looking towards other opportunities like mining in Australia. What was interesting about that whole experience was I had just come from the UK and Spain, where I'd been sort of living and studying over the preceding years. And we ended up having a couple of very successful principal investments in the UK and Spain. So this is going back to sort of 2010, 2011. And that was really kind of my first taste of the pure principal build a project from the absolute sort of bare naked framework up, from the bare bones, if you will. So that was in the UK, a very large potash development project, which is subsequently sold on to a publicly listed company and then on reprivatized, as well as a really high quality polymetallic or set of polymetallic assets in the Iberian Pyrite Belt in Spain.
That wasn't Sirius Minerals, was it?
It was. We sold that project to Sirius Minerals in 2011.
Okay. Yeah, I know that well. I'm from that area in the UK, so I know that Sirius Minerals project pretty well, that potash deposit. So that's interesting that you were involved in that.
Yeah, so I was part of the team that put together the project originally. So it was a very right from the early start, assemble the mineral rights, put together the mineral rights sharing agreements between all of the different landowners. As you probably know, there are thousands of different landowners that overlie that project area. So it's quite a complex, effort to put those rights agreements together. And so that was a little good opportunity to sort of figure out how to put some structuring skills to use in terms of designing that. Sadly, that project had sort of a checkered history thereafter. I think I left in late 2011 or early 2012, and the project was sort of on track to go into a one development model to produce sulfate of potash, which we felt was a really strong development play, and certainly in today's market, it would be well rewarded. And then it sort of changed track, as you know, and I think around 2015, 2016, went towards a polyhalite as a raw product proposition, which is more complicated, of course. And I think that project, since has been acquired by Anglo-American and reprivatized. But that was a project that I was involved in as sort of the founding team. Very, very interesting to be involved in building that right from the start, and quite a few good learning points, obviously, going through that. So, after that process, actually went and joined another corporate advisory team, again, sort of mixed principal investments and corporate advisory, where I did remain focused on the mining space, but also sort of mining related entities. So services companies, these types of things. And it was really around 2015, 2016, after several years of doing sort of both equity and debt work, both on the growth capital side, but obviously, as you can imagine, a lot of restructuring work during 2012 to 2015, when we had that sort of mining downturn in Australia. It was about that 2016 period of time when I decided to go back sort of to a purely principal side of the game, if you will. And I put together a sort of a multifamily office called Park Capital. And the objective there was to take a step back. It was to look at really large scale macro themes, macro trends that we saw unfolding over the next 10, 20, and 30 years. And then basically determine where we should have exposure in terms of particular markets, particular metals, and then where we should be acquiring the specific exposure in the ground to those particular themes and metals. So obviously I had a very strong perspective and some very strong views on agricultural minerals. So, obviously did a lot of research in the potash and phosphate markets during the early 2010s. And I have some very strong inclinations towards phosphate in terms of its geographical distribution and logistical advantages in certain regions. We also went and acquired some small gold assets and also some nickel assets. But, you know, in thinking about where, you know, we got to now, you know, sitting here talking about Barton Gold, it was around that same time, late 2016, early 2017, that we were looking around the world and saying, okay, things are starting to get a bit funky, right? Starting to smell a bit funky and certainly look like they're heading down the path of instability. And there's really, there are two significant events that happened in 2016, in sort of the latter half of 2016, which kind of cemented the thematic for us that we are heading into a riskier world. And this was in the United States, the election of Donald Trump as president, and in the UK, the advent of Brexit, right? And we can set aside all politics when we think about those two events. The only thing that we need to know, which was very apparent at the time, was that both of those events were essentially marketed and predicated and based very much upon the notion of a return to sort of nationalism and protectionism and closed borders and essentially defragmentation of the post-World War II NATO-aligned world order. Now, that world order, that sort of increasing cohesion between markets and countries and allies, is essentially the framework upon which the modern economy has both existed and thrived, but also outgrown the natural boundaries that are available to it if you have things like tariffs and friction between markets, whether you're talking about friction in people, money, ideas, and so on. And so, you know, looking around these sort of macro themes, we saw a world where post-GFC, central banks, central bank governors had discovered for the first time this concept of free money. And after bailing out the banks in 2009 and 10 with the original TARP package, which was ended up being about $1 trillion. What was interesting was that after the market had recovered for the period from 2010 to 2016, the printing presses were just left running. So there was all this cheap money, all this M1 and M2 money supply being pumped into the market. And suddenly, you know, the US money supply was, you know, more than double what it was pre-GFC. We also had a return to record levels of corporate credit and record levels of consumer credit and not very high quality consumer credit. So a lot of the same things that we saw happening with the GFC. And then again, these two events, very, very sort of central political events in the Western world really said to us, okay, we were worried that, you know, we were thinking that it might be time to go to a risk mitigation strategy. What metals typically are preferred in those types of scenarios? Well, gold is one of them. And then when you look at, again, those two key central events, they really in so many ways foretold the world that we see today. And today we are essentially enjoying is the wrong word. We are living through the unhappy fruits and consequences of what happens when nations, nation states, long-term allies all of a sudden shrink their worldview dramatically and sort of make 2 and 4 year politically expedient decisions based around individualism as opposed to long-term strategic alliance-based maneuvers. So I think it's sort of interesting that the world sort of evolved quite clearly from those things. And from those moments, we started looking around saying, okay, well, we now see a very unstable world ahead. We now think we should go substantially into gold allocation. We have expertise in capturing, exploring, developing projects. So we should go big on gold. Where should we do that? Well, if we believe that we are going to have rising geopolitical instability, we should be doing that in a tier one country where we could be sure that tomorrow, if we're successful today and we find a lot of gold today, tomorrow we're going to own our assets and not have them nationalized. So, you know, being in Australia was a pretty easy place to be from that perspective. And then it was really just a hunt for, you know, where are the opportunities? And that really is looking at it with the private equity hat on. What are the good geological opportunities? But where are the mispricings, the lack of recognition in the market? Where are the real opportunities to put together a strategic package quietly and cheaply? And that led us to South Australia.
Okay. So was that a pivot for the company then to move into gold? Was the company into other commodities prior to that decision?
Yeah, so the family office was investing in a number of different commodity exposures. Barton Gold was actually built around the opportunity in South Australia. So it's essentially a completely clean company that was designed for that purpose. But the principal exposures that we had been building and working on in the time since were smaller scale gold, agricultural minerals, primarily phosphate, and then nickel as well. So we actually acquired some nickel assets in Western Australia in early 2016, essentially right at the time when the nickel market was diving and nobody else was interested in nickel. But to us, we sort of looked forward 10, 15 years and saw, well, you know, if the EV or the electrification or battery powered everything evolution is 10% as successful as we think it needs to be, and the market is shaping up to support, well, then, you know, having class one nickel is definitely something you want to have in your portfolio.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder if I can just go back a little bit to, you said your family's mine. I wonder if you can tell us a bit more about that. You said it was an excuse to sort of run into the woods and sort of play around, but what was that whole business about?
Look, that was a small-scale exploration and development project in Idaho. So it was essentially extension rejuvenation of a small old mine. If you're familiar with mining in North America, particularly in sort of the mountainous regions of the Pacific Northwest, you know, the area is peppered with, you know, old artisanal style mines and sort of, you know, old fashioned adits and drives and shaft style mining. So you know, it by no means was this anything, you know, substantial. And I think it was in so many ways probably a hobby for the parents as much as it was, you know, a hobby for the kids to go out and play in the woods. Okay. In Idaho. But yeah, it was always something that was you know, we were very outdoors oriented when I was younger. And it just sort of is one of those things that sort of created a sort of a mental nexus of enjoyment for me and in terms of mining. And it was obviously something that was very interesting to a young man when you're told that you can go into a hillside and blow stuff up and there's gold.
What's not to love, you know?
that's right.
But Alex, I wanted to ask about your educational background a bit, because it's really impressive. I mean, 2 degrees, as you said, in economics and finance. It was Santa Clara, right? The university.
Yeah,
and
that's then, right. Yeah.
2 master's degrees. And my first question is, why is such an extensive education? Did you feel like you needed it to succeed, or was it just because you were really interested in what you were studying?
Yeah, look, good question. So my undergraduate degrees were at Santa Clara University in California. I have an honors degree in economics and an honors degree in finance. And the reason for that was that those 2 degrees, I sort of focused on the divergence between those two things. So there was, you know, there's not a lot of overlap between those two, but you know, economics, and in particular macroeconomics and sort of big picture, almost sort of market psychology style concepts have always been of interest to me. So I started trading securities and doing analysis when I was probably like 12 years old. So I was always kind of looking for kind of big picture patterns and the reasons why. So that kind of led me to an initial focus on sort of the economics side of studies. And the finance degree was really more focused on the accounting and structuring and sort of pure finance side of the ledger. And the reason for that was I had a pretty clear idea when I was young that I wanted to go into business in some capacity, and I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I sort of knew that by the age of 14. I come from a very large medical family. So essentially everybody in our family at the level of the parents and the aunts and uncles and so on are all physicians. And as a family, we have a very strong connection with the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. My grandfather was the head of radiology there. My uncle was the head of pulmonology. Both my parents went to medical school there. So it was kind of one of these things where the natural progression may have been to go into medicine. But actually, my other grandfather was himself an entrepreneur, very much sort of the American story, if you will, first generation immigrant. Put himself through business undergraduate and business school, working in restaurants and he really became my role model. So that was the reason for that kind of approach. And then going to graduate school was really, of course, an opportunity to do two things: one, to substantially expand upon the economics work that I had done. So I applied to and was accepted to Oxford University for the Master's in Financial Economics program at the Said Business School there. And two, it was also an opportunity to kind of go back internationally. So I had studied in Spain at the Pompeu Fabra, which is an economics university in Spain, during my undergraduate years. An opportunity to go back internationally to really experience the educational experience of sort of deep historical educational institution like Oxford. And then also to really challenge myself in a program that was being offered for the first year by an excellent faculty that was both a mixed business faculty associated with business school, but also the Oxford economics faculty, which is widely regarded. So it was, again, that perfect mix of a degree that almost brought together those sort of two worlds, the theoretical, philosophical world of the economic studies with the very practical world of the business side. So that was just very attractive to me. And then, once I was there, I completed that program. I had originally sort of mentally budgeted another year to potentially continue studies. And so I went over to Cambridge and then did a master's in management degree. So in some ways, sort of creating a synthetic but much more technical MBA between Oxford and Cambridge, which is a bit of a funny mix. And I certainly got grief from some of my English friends for not having clear alliances between one or the other. But for me, it was just, coming from the US and then attending 800-year-old educational institutions is just it's just a world-changing experience.
And so then what would be your advice to people who, future investors or entrepreneurs who maybe don't have the formal training that you've had? What would you say they should focus on, maybe in terms of a subject or in terms of an approach, in order to kind of maximize the value they get from the education they have, in order, in terms of being an investor or an entrepreneur or something like that?
Yeah, look, I think there's two key things. And one thing that I really wish I had studied a bit, or at least actually acknowledged more at the time, was psychology, right? So much of the market that we see today in particular is psychology driven, and you know, it's emotionally driven. It's psychology, and it's, you know, the market has always been about emotion and psychology, optimism and fear, and essentially fear and greed, right? Like, you know, you see people who have track fear and greed indices to things going on in the market, and by and large, you can get about 80% of it right just based upon taking a reading of fear versus greed at various times. But you know, as we have progressed into the age of the smartphone, where everyone can access information all the time, and as we have progressed into the age of social media and democratized this and socialized that, and you know, trading platforms where people can not only access media and information, but an incredible amount of media and information is being pushed at them, some very good, some very bad. What we're seeing in the market, I think, now is just a huge shift in what really drives markets. And that really is social psychology. So that is something that I think is almost necessary now to study if you want to be an investor, because if you want to figure out where things are going, and I, you know, I've generally found this to be true, is step back, look at the big picture, try to figure out where we obviously need to be or are going to be in 10 or 15 years. And then from there, you can work backwards and say, well, if we're going to be here in 15 years, then in 7 or 10 years, we must be some way along that line here. Right now, you can't, I think, trying to pick things on a daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly basis is becoming increasingly difficult. We're having increasing volatility in markets. It's getting harder and harder and harder to become a trader in sort of the purest sense of the word. I think we really have to, and I always suggest, you know, a focus on really focusing on the big picture, because if you interpret that correctly, you can then position yourself today to benefit from that. And the real question is, can you give yourself that exposure to that thesis, which is a very high conviction thesis, cheaply enough? And if you can acquire that exposure cheaply enough, and if you can hold that exposure cheaply enough, you can then defeat the monster that is time. And time then works for you, and you will win more frequently and on a larger scale. So again, if you can see the future, you can win. The question is, can you hold between now and the future? And that's why I focus on macro. But look, the other thing, and you know, the counterpart to your question, you know, there's sort of the educational thing is, you know, what to look for, and you know, I guess what do I see as increasingly important there? But in terms of being an entrepreneur and doing this stuff, it's really just getting in and doing the hard work, right? So you have to take every opportunity to actually get your hands dirty, right? And you have to take risk, and things will fail, and it will hurt, and it will set you back. But you know, you want to make sure you're obviously pursuing things that have a reasonable return to risk proposition. But you know, if you get your hands dirty and you fail and you learn, the next time you're going to have a better chance of success. You'll tune your strategy, you'll tune your approach, you'll tune what risk you take. You'll know what to watch out for in contracts. You'll know what to watch out for in counterparties. Those are your two key risks, right? Is the people that you're dealing with and the terms on which you're dealing. So you learn this, and you learn from this. One top piece of advice: pay really close attention to the mistakes that other people are making, because it is a priceless free education. And I have seen some incredibly stupid decisions made by some of the people that I have worked for. I have gotten a multi-million dollar education watching them make those mistakes, right? So it's that's definitely there. And you know, to you know, in the context of mining, and you know, this is a really good example. You've got to do it, and if you do it you're going to learn out of necessity. You know, my background, I have no formal training in mining or exploration. I'm not a geologist. I'm not a metallurgist. I'm not an engineer. But I've found a way to obviously work with really high quality people who are very capable geologists, very capable metallurgists, very capable engineers, and then bring my skill sets and my experience, my awareness as a complement to those skill sets. And that's very powerful, right? No one person can do all things, but if you can find really good people, which is where we started the conversation, if you find really good people, you can accomplish incredible things by working together.
Indeed, indeed. I think what you say, Alexander, about the psychology, that's a huge thing today in the markets. I think the markets can be extremely irrational, but it really is driven on the narrative or the story what people are saying. And when that shifts, then the gains can be huge. But I do think it's very difficult to trade a market these days. You have to look at the bigger picture. You know, that saying, if in doubt, zoom out, you know, that really is true. Look at the bigger picture, look what's coming down the track. And clearly you and the team at Barton Gold did that with all the work you did moving into gold and that risk mitigation strategy. There was an awful lot of thought put into that, it seems, from what you said earlier, and it wasn't something that you made very lightly, and you put together this gold package that's pretty remarkable, really, isn't it? I mean, there's quite a big existing JORC resource, 1.1 million ounces, is that right? A 2012 JORC resource?
That's correct, yeah.
So a significant. Before we just talk a little bit about the company and where it's at, did you not also feel that the company should perhaps explore down the energy metals route, you know, copper, lithium, when we take into account the green economy, the green shift? You've purely gone for the sort of safe haven, inflation-proof gold?
Yeah, look, with Barton Gold, it was conceived of and essentially designed to be a very specific play, right? And gold, from a macroeconomic standpoint, gold was certainly at the center of that thesis. But the reason why we shaped it probably even more around gold and have really taken this very pure play gold, pure play South Australian perspective is that when we were looking for significant gold assets in Australia, you know, we looked at a lot of Western Australian assets, right? So traditionally speaking, if somebody says, I want to invest in gold in Australia, essentially Western Australia, right? In terms of the investable universe and sort of the awareness, if you will. And we looked at a number of notable assets there, looked at acquiring several assets that are now in play in public companies. But we became aware of an opportunity in South Australia in late 2017 and early 2018. So the assets that we own now were owned by another company at that time who had run into some technical difficulties in their operations. But we started looking at the assets, but then we started looking more broadly in the state. And what we realized was that South Australia as a state is one of the more geologically interesting but untouched opportunities, not only in Australia, but kind of really in the world in terms of first world jurisdictions. So as to gold mineralization, South Australia represents 25% of Australia's gold resources, but accounts only for about 2.5% of its annual gold production. And that gold production is essentially all secondary or byproduct gold production from three major mines, which are Olympic Dam, which is owned by BHP Billiton, and then Prominent Hill and Carrapateena, which are owned by Oz Minerals. So, you know, we thought that was very interesting. As a state, you know, so the state of South Australia is about 950,000 square kilometers of surface area, I believe. About 50% of which is the Gawler Craton, which is one of the most richly structured and richly mineralized cratons in the world. And then looking back across the past 30 years, it was very clear to us that essentially exploration in the Gawler Craton, and in particular for gold, had been virtually non-existent. So There were some really interesting events in the 1990s that actually had everybody quite interested in South Australia, and that was the discovery of the Challenger mineralization, which became the Challenger open pit and then underground mine, and the discovery of the Tunkillia project. Now, we now own both of those assets and all the surrounding ground. But so in 1995 or 1996, when those were discovered, there was this enormous amount of this sort of this burst of awareness and interest in South Australia. But then as we continued to go into the later part of the 1990s and the gold price went to 500 US and 400 US and 300 US, the impetus, the interest in exploration in South Australia fell off, and people went more predominantly to the West. And the reason for that is because in Western Australia, you have predominantly outcropping styles of mineralization, outcropping mineralization, whereas in South Australia, you are generally exploring under cover. And that cover might be 2 meters thick, it might be 20 meters thick, but it presents additional challenges to exploration. And so if the gold price is low, people are going to go where it is easier to explore. And that for us presented a really significant opportunity because we realized that this ground which we now have, was massively underinvested, massively underexplored. It was not understood, but the work that we did was indicating that there were some very significant repeating structures that were unrecognized and present really large exploration opportunities. So we put together, we assembled a package of ground that's about 4,660 square kilometers of wholly owned ground, as well as joint venture gold rights. And that ground represents substantially the majority of all significant historical gold producing and gold exploration ground in the Central Gawler Craton, which is kind of a 60,000 square kilometer area of interest for us. We assembled that ground. We also acquired the only gold mill in the region. So this is, you know, the only processing infrastructure available in the region. And we started bringing in a lot of new technology and a lot of old technology and new applications. And that then confirmed to us, hey, what we've got here is something that is actually a proven gold district where we can assemble and have assembled a district scale play with infrastructure dominance at a substantial discount to what this would have cost to assemble in Western Australia. So that was kind of the strategy there. And you know, indeed we put all this together and we owned all these assets and we were doing work for about a year before we actually revealed to the market that we had done this. And from that time, a number of other explorers have now come in around us and started investing heavily. So, you know, we like, you know, we sort of like to look at this and say, look, we are basically reestablishing a proven gold district where a premium quality sort of exposure to a proven gold district where we've got first mover advantage and an infrastructure advantage, which provides all kinds of options in terms of third-party toll milling, but also starting our own operations, which is not generally a possibility for most explorers, short of spending $150 or $200 million.
Mm-hmm. And the focus is on two projects, isn't it? Tarcoola and Twinkilla, is that right?
That's correct, yes. Yeah. So these two projects are in what we call our southern project hub. Mm-hmm. And the reason for the focus on those projects is that is where we were doing a lot of technical work and really identified that there is likely to be substantial repeating mineralization, or I should say substantial repeating structure, which is conducive to hosting the same mineralization, which has been observed during various mining booms over the past 130 years. So, I mean, the Tarcoola project, our mining lease there, covers the ground that was the site of the South Australian gold rush, the Tarcoola gold rush in 1893. From 1900 to 1955, you know, the old timers, as it were, you know, mining artisanally, you know, mining by hand into the hillside there. And they pulled out about 77,000 ounces of gold at around 40 grams per ton during that time. And they were really just scratching the surface there in terms of the smallest vein sets that were coming to surface. So Tarcoola is very, 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 very structurally complex, but a lot of repeating structure that we've identified now. And we're now sort of systematically working on building up a regional structural model. And then Tunkillia is very interesting to us because, you know, Tunkillia is an asset that was discovered back in 1996. Mm-hmm. Following its discovery, essentially, the gold price declined to a point where this asset became to be of lesser interest. And the asset sort of always sat in somebody's back pocket as sort of third or fourth fiddle. But the work that was done at Tunkillia in the late 1990s and some drilling as well in the early 2000s, it identified not only the original footprint of what is now the 223 deposit, but it also picked up some early indicators of a much larger footprint of mineralization or a much larger footprint of potentially multiple distinct deposits over several kilometers of strike on these major regional shear zones. So, you know, we have done a lot of additional work there and we have remodeled a lot of this data using much higher order analysis that is available today than was available 30 years ago. And we've drill tested a few predictions based upon that geophysical modeling. Late last year in November, we confirmed two new gold zones, which were both located and oriented as we predicted. And we've just finished drilling a third high priority target, which of course we're hoping will come back a little bit later this year with confirmation of a third new gold zone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if that is the case, then, you know, we may have doubled the strike of mineralization at that project in less than 10,000 meters of drilling. So that's quite remarkable if you consider that, you know, our 223 deposit there presently holds about 965,000 ounces across about 2.5 kilometers of strike. You know, we've already mapped out 1.5 kilometers of new gold mineralization. We think that we're onto a couple of additional zones of potential new gold mineralization. So the potential there is to grow a project significantly within a relatively small footprint. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, then if we think about growing up, or probably more specifically growing down, the existing resource itself was drilled predominantly, or the drilling that has informed that resource, I should say, was drilled predominantly during the late 1990s and early 2000s when the US dollar gold price was between $300 and $800 per ounce. So even that drilling has an artificially limited search domain in terms of what we would do today. So we think that that 965,000 ounce deposit has got potential to grow downward. If you look at the profile of that mineralization, sort of the average vertical profile from top of mineralization to the base of our mineralized wireframe there in an actual open pit wireframe, the vertical relief is only about 125 meters. So, you know, we think there's a lot of potential to grow that to depth. And if we're growing that to depth and we're finding new deposits within a couple kilometers in all sorts of directions, and we grow those to depth, we think that becomes a very significant development hub. So taking that together with Tunkillia, where you've potentially got, you know, what we're targeting, I should say, is what we're hoping for is a multi-million ounce development base. And pairing that with Tarcoola, which is only 70 kilometers away, which is, you know, shallow high-grade mineralization. These two things complement each other perfectly as a single large-scale development.
So what would you say is the main objective here? Is it to prove up the strike a bit more, to increase the reserve? I noticed that the market cap is about 17 million Aussie dollars, which is just under 10 million pounds. So, you know, that's fairly low, I would say, for a company that has that 1.1 million ounce JORC resource. I see as well that some recent news, you've raised a decent bit of cash purely from the sale of, well, I wonder if you can explain that. Was it from gold? Was it gold that was sort of lying around and, or not? Not quite.
Yeah. So, and just to sort of provide a bit more context. So, we have a market capitalization in the vicinity of about 35 million Australian. So, what you're seeing, and this happens unfortunately with some of the financial platforms, they don't recognize escrowed shares in calculating the market cap. So, our market cap is 35 Australian about 20 sterling. But you're right, that is cheap still. You know, I mentioned before, you know, we took a good hard look around the market assets that we wanted to acquire. And similarly, when we look at, you know, tracking ourselves in terms of how we're valued relative to our peers in the market, we take a good hard and very strict look at, you know, our comparable companies. And one thing that we have detailed in our presentation, as many companies do, is sort of a comparables analysis set, or, you know, a evaluation compared to our peers. Now, we take a more stringent approach to comparables analysis than many companies out there. You know, we don't compare ourselves to high grade underground gold miners, and we're not comparing ourselves to the, you know, ASX listed gold space generally. What we do is we look at our true peers, our true comparables on the ASX. So our comparables analysis set is limited to companies that are ASX listed with Australian domiciled projects that are large scale, continuous, open pittable projects. So true scale economies of scale opportunities, and which mineralization is sub 1.3 gram per ton. So ASX listed, Australian domiciled, large scale open pit, sub 1.3 gram per ton. So very narrow window that we've painted for ourselves. And on the ASX, there are essentially seven people, including Barton, seven companies, including Barton, that meet those sort of compound criteria. And what's interesting is, and this goes back to an earlier portion of our conversation, of those seven companies, our six peers are all based in Western Australia. Barton Gold is the only South Australian component of that peer set. And of our peers, on average, our peers are valued at around $70 to $75 Australian per ounce, whereas we're valued at around $25 Australian per ounce. So in a way, you know, we think that actually captures fairly nicely that sort of recognition discount we are talking about, you know, where WA companies, which are by all accounts, you know, our peers comparables, are valued at three times our price. Even those that are the most perfectly comparable to us are valued at least twice what we are valued at on an enterprise value per resource ounce basis. And, you know, another important point there for us when we look at that is to say, well, okay, so that is on a resource ounce basis alone. Of this peer group, of this set of comparable companies, Barton Gold is the only one that owns a gold mill. So while we believe be very attractively priced on a resources basis, we also have a mill which allows us to essentially progress into operations by crossing a much smaller drawbridge when it comes to capital costs, if that makes sense. Every single one of our peers would have a capital cost of between $150 million and $1 billion to get their projects in operations, whereas we have a recommissioning cost with some minor refurb to restart an existing plant that was running at the end of 2018. So that's, you know, yeah, we perceive of ourselves as both a sort of a deep value, but also a growth opportunity because of that exploration momentum that we do have. And to your other question, you know, we do have some other unique features. You know, we completed our IPO in June of 2021. We raised $15 million at that time. We raised more money than we thought was necessary for us because we saw an increasingly difficult market ahead. I think it'd be fair to say that that has continued to be the case. And, you know, it's a very, very difficult market for gold equities at the moment, despite the fact that gold and any, you know, long-term perspective is trading at sort of weighted average all-time highs. But we have used that capital both judiciously and carefully. We had $10.8 million as of the 31st of March. But one of the things that, again, does set us apart from our peers is that we do have opportunities to extract value from our existing asset base. Mm. In June, we both sold a portion of Surplus Camp for about $740,000. And we did also sell a parcel of gold. So we received a $1 million prepayment for that gold parcel. And that was that gold came from a clean out of our plants at the northern hub there at our central Gawler mill. And it's probably something that, you know, people wouldn't have expected, and certainly is unusual for your average explorer. But we have we have multiple projects that we'll be looking at to extract additional value for shareholders. And the point of that, of course, is that even if we are in a difficult market, which indeed we are, you know, I think much of the market will have to be standing down their activities to preserve capital or raise capital at discounts to already, you know, deeply depressed prices. You know, we're very well capitalized to continue moving forward. And while we are very carefully but aggressively destocking our capital on high value exploration, we are also restocking that capital from internal sources. And that is what allows us to look at stretching the net benefit of our IPO far beyond that original $15 million. And that's something that we've been looking at, for the past couple of years of how can we find ways to create value of these assets? And now we're starting to sort of show investors, hey, this is what we're doing. And this is how we are essentially defending ourselves from having to go back to market and therefore defending you from dilution.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think the valuation difference is so big in the first place? I mean, you said 2 times going up to 3 times. It's a lot.
Yeah, look, I think it's just a recognition issue. There was a huge amount of interest in South Australia in the mid-90s. But then again, with that sort of decline in the gold price, everybody essentially went to Western Australia and just nobody came back, if that makes sense. It just never got that momentum. And so it's always been, in a kind of a funny way, a flyover state when you think about, you know, gold exploration. You've got, you know, a lot of gold exploration and operations in Queensland, some in New South Wales. And then the next stop for most people is to get on a plane and fly over to Western Australia. But South Australia just has been left behind. And the more that people have not been investing and exploring, and the more that people therefore have not been announcing gold discoveries, the more people have forgotten about it. And that is exactly the thing that I look for, that we have looked for in terms of spot opportunities. If you can find some of the most richly structured and richly mineralized ground in the world that nobody apparently wants or is paying attention to, that's a very attractive opportunity.
Yeah, it kind of speaks to the psychology of it, as we were talking about earlier. It's not trendy, so then people kind of forget about it almost.
Yeah, look, and the other thing too, which definitely plays a part in this, is that, you know, mining knowledge of the ground lives and dies with individuals. So it's not uncommon that entire areas and very attractive assets have just been forgotten about intergenerationally, and they're kind of rediscovered, every 20 or 30 or 50 years. And the reality is, you know, if we had, you know, had better records, you know, or if you know, people had sort of maintained an active interest in the area, they probably never would have been forgotten about. But, you know, there are any number of reasons why very attractive assets are overlooked, and lack of awareness is a really big one.
It's definitely true, the lack of awareness, getting that recognition, but it will come. Just keep staying there and putting the message out, banging the drum, and the recognition will come when you do the right things. Just thinking on that, you kind of alluded to earlier about potential sort of tougher times in the short term, maybe. You're saying how well the company is capitalized, so there's no need for shareholders to concern about having to raise capital in a tough market. So maybe just to finish off, Alexander, what do you see as the sort of the future? Let's say the short-term future, because I think the longer-term future, I think most people would agree that the green economy shift and high interest rate environment, risk of inflation, things like gold and precious metals are going to do well as of course, the green economy metals. But in the shorter term, do you see some disorder ahead?
I do, yeah. I think, you know, I speak to a lot of friends and colleagues who, you know, invest across the sort of industrial and economic spectrum, and work for $20 billion funds and $2 billion funds and $200 million funds and $20 million family offices. And what we see happening right now is a general pullback from risk. And that's not because these investors are risk averse. These are genuine risk acquirers, right? These are sophisticated, aggressive investors who know how to price risk, and they buy risk. And they are long-term strategic investors, so they will hold through difficult times because they make conviction investments. But what is happening right now is we have so many points of volatility in the market that I'm seeing these people pull back from investment, and it's not because they don't want to invest, they don't have the capital, or they're afraid of the risk. What they're seeing is that we have asset bubbles that are stretched too far. We have investors who are over-levered and essentially are in, you know, sort of facing credit calls and margin calls. And they're watching the general market sentiment turn, and they are recognizing that other people are going to screw this up. So they probably should, you know, not be buying stuff at a price when they can get it at a 20 or 30% discount in 6 to 12 months time. So, you know, I do think that the smartest risk acquirers are sort of waiting for things to settle out. I do think that the people that are sort of traditionally generalist investors who might have ventured into the mining space are going to be getting scared by falling metals prices. The long-term metrics around metals consumption requirements, metals demand, essentially institutionally crystallized demand for green tech metals in a way that we haven't seen it. I think that macro is very clear. So I think there's going to be a lot of bargain hunting. I think as the general market continues to sort of suffer, there's going to be a lot of humming and hawing and soul searching amongst people investing in the riskier end of the market. And I do think, not to be too sort of, you know, Dr. Doom about it, but I do sort of see a valley of death for the next, you know, 12 to 18 months for companies that are undercapitalized and have high holding costs. I think they're going to have to go out and raise money at deeply discounted valuations. And stop doing work. And that's why, you know, we have been focused on putting the effort into making sure that we're not only developing our assets from an exploration standpoint, but also developing on the corporate side and extracting this value to show people, hey, don't worry, we can keep going at pace without essentially exposing ourselves to a massive recap risk, if you will. And then when the market turns, as it will, as it must, because it always does, and because eventually institutional capital will reorganize to the long side in the gold market. Barton Gold will be very well positioned. It will have continued sprinting forward for 12, 18, 24 months while everyone else has been slowing down. And that then positions Barton to be sort of front of pack, best in show, moving into development studies and development phases, and essentially leapfrog many of its competitors for capital.
Excellent. Well, that's a good way to finish off. I think I was going to ask you what the plans for Barton Gold would be, but you finished off there quite nicely explaining that. So thank you very much. It's a very compelling case you've made there, and I would tend to agree that the next perhaps 12 to 18 months are going to be a little bit choppy waters for investors. But, you know, forewarned is forearmed, and you've just got to take action accordingly and keep an eye on the companies that are well capitalized, that have compelling projects and are keeping on throughout this time to, because investors will be able to pick up some bargains as well if they hang on. But the hardest thing I always find is holding on to dry powder. It's, you have cash and you you don't want to sit it in the bank. You want to put it somewhere, but holding on to it is not a bad strategy. And keeping an eye on what's going on. So, James, do you have any further questions for Alexander?
No, I'm good. But it was a really insightful chat. So, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Alexander Scanlon, the CEO of Barton Gold. Thank you for your time.
Likewise, thank you.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.